On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother, Jesus, and his disciples were also invited. When they had no more wine, his mother turned to Jesus and said, "They have no more wine." "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied. "For my hour has not yet come." But she went to the servants and said, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Nearby there were 5 or 6 stone jars used for ceremonial washing, each holding about 20 or 30 gallons each. So Jesus told them to fill them with water to the brim. And they did so. Then Jesus told them to draw some out and take it to the master. When the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine, he didn't know where it came from, but the servants, they knew. The servants, they knew where it had come from. The master of the banquet called over the bridegroom and said, "Everyone brings out their best wine first. And then when the people have had too much to drink, serve the cheaper wine later. But you have saved the best until now." It was at Cana of Galilee that Jesus performed the first of many signs that would reveal His glory. And His disciples believed in Him there. This is the word of the Lord. And we say together, thanks be to God. There is always something happening behind the scenes at a wedding. Nothing is ever quite as it seems at a wedding. Because if anything can go wrong at a wedding, it will go wrong at a wedding. There was this one time where we had to have a shotgun start to the wedding. You know, where you start at a different point than what you expected to start because the groom's parents were late to the show. There was this time where we had a wedding and there was an intermission in the middle because it was a June wedding and all of us men were sweating enough we could make our own river if you knew, but see, we're behind all the tuxes. And we had an intermission so that the groom could sit down to keep him from passing out. Or that family wedding is a destination wedding, and I'd kind of been on, the pastor had been on them about getting their marriage certificate, and they said, yeah, we'll get it. And the day comes up, and they said, "Oh, we left it at home," which is 2 hours away, and you say, "Okay, we'll make it work," only to find out there were some legal problems, and so they never even bothered getting a marriage certificate. And they didn't tell you that part till after the wedding was over. Or what about the fact that there's always family feuds going on that nobody but the family and the pastor knows about because everybody thinks the pastor needs to know everything so that the pastor doesn't say something. The pastor doesn't talk to the family, talks to you two. Leave the pastor out of the drama, sorry. The mother-in-law acts like they like the daughter-in-law, and the daughter-in-law will act like she likes the mother-in-law, but they don't like each other. And so-and-so might show up, and so-and-so might not show up, so if they don't show up, do this, and if they do show up, watch for this. There's always more happening behind the scenes at a wedding than what you ever realize. How about this fact? I'm going to be crucified for this, but that's all right. What about the fact that never for the remainder of the marriage will the groom be that well groomed the rest of his life? If you want to see him in a tux again, you're going to have to put a tux on him when you have to bury him. They're never going to smell that good again in their life. This is where I'm going to be crucified. And let's be real. She's never going to look as beautiful as she does on her wedding day. Because that outfit costs more than an entire wardrobe. And the hairdo is 3 hours of preparation and the makeup another 2, all done by professionals. So let's just be real for a second. See, nobody talks about this at a wedding. You know why? Because at a wedding, it's not that problems don't exist, it's that they're covered up by the beauty of the day. We're willing to set aside all of the problems so that the wedding will be beautiful. But sometimes marriage ain't beautiful. Men don't say a word. And women don't say a word either. Because there's always something happening behind the scenes of a wedding that most people have no idea what's going on. Good photographers take good photographs. They take pictures of what you expect and it looks beautiful and everybody looks back at them, you know, once every 20 years and oohs and ahs and oh, that's so pretty. Great photographers take pictures of what's happening behind the scenes. In fact, the pictures that end up on the wall are usually not the pictures of the one where you're standing here on the stage with the pastor. It's usually the one that no one expects. It was just you being natural. Great photographers always show you what's happening behind the scenes of a wedding. And John, who is also the writer of Revelation, who has an ability to take pictures and paint them with his words, gives us a picture of not what's happening on the dance floor or while the bride is shoving cake in the face of the groom. Which, by the way, since my wife's not in here, will you pick on her after church? She lied to me for 7 years. Every wedding we went to, don't you dare do that to me. Don't you dare do that to me. Guess who did it to who? So while good photographers take a picture of all of that, great photographers, the writer of John takes a picture of what's happening in the kitchen. Doesn't capture the beauty of the day, but actually captures the problem that's happening behind the scenes. And did you hear the problem? It's very simple. They have no wine. Now, this was a big problem because in the middle of this scene, you find the mother of Jesus. She's never assigned a name in the story, which I think is odd. The mother of Jesus is involved because this is an intimate scene. You see, Mary is thinking about the bride and the groom. And how if they run out of wine, they will never make it as a married couple because no one will accept the bid of his carpentry business ever again because they'll be known around town as the party that ran out of wine. Never again can they go into a public place and if they come face to face with someone that was at their bridal party or at their wedding, they'll have to turn and go the other direction. You know why? Because everyone at the wedding will sue them for running out of wine, as was the custom of the day. You see, Mary is worried because if she doesn't fix this problem, this will change the trajectory of their lives forever and not in the positive way, in a way that they'll never recover from. And then you have the servants that are worried because the servants work for the master, the wedding planner. And if the wedding planner is known as the one who allowed the wine to run out at a wedding, his business is going to go bankrupt. And when the business goes bankrupt, guess who has no more work? And because you're servants and not the master, you live paycheck to paycheck, so you don't have money to go far enough away to where your reputation won't precede you. You see, if this problem doesn't get fixed, this will change the trajectory of their lives forever. This is a very serious problem. This wasn't a miscalculation of wine. This wasn't a mishap. This wasn't a mistake. Something happened that they could not control for this to be the result. This was a serious problem. And guess what? The mother of Jesus does. She doesn't identify the problem. She gets involved in the problem. I preached from this text a few weeks ago to my classmates. And one of my classmates is from India. He now lives in the United States, an American citizen and a very, very intelligent man. And he said, "You Western people have no idea what happens at an Eastern wedding." And I want to say, that's my fault. How? Enlighten me. He said, the scene here is an intimate scene. Let me give you an example. He said, if you invite me over to your house for dinner, and the dinner isn't ready, I will go and wait in the living room, and you and I will have conversation. What I will not do is I won't go into the kitchen, because would you let me in the kitchen? I said, no, why wouldn't you? And I said, because you're a guest. And guests aren't responsible for being in the kitchen and anything that's going on there. And he said, so when dinner's ready, guess what? We'll come to the table and eat. And when dinner's done, I won't take my dishes into the kitchen. Would you let me do that? I said, no. Why wouldn't you let me do that? Because you're a guest. We'll take care of what's happening in the kitchen. Then we'll go back to the living room and sit down and have a good conversation. And then I'll leave. But he said, think about this. When your family comes over, Where's the first place they go? To the kitchen. To see if you need any help. And after dinner is over, what do you try and do if you're at a family's house? You gather your plates and at the very least take them into the kitchen, and someone else might start doing dishes. Why? Because this is an intimate setting. So the very fact that Mary wasn't out partying with the rest of them and she was behind the scenes in the kitchen tells us she was intimately involved in this problem. Translation. Before she ever took it to the bride and groom, she took their problem on herself as if it were her own. You want to know how we transform the world? We stop standing on the outside of problems, identifying the problem that everybody else has, and we get involved in people's lives in such a way that their problem becomes our problem, and their problem keeps us awake at night. But you see, I anticipated these blank faces because I know we won't do it for the world because we don't practice it in the church. Charles, I have job security pass tonight. I mean, at least give me time, you know. Because here's what happens. Everybody identifies the problem to the pastor or the leaders. But what happens when it becomes our problem and we say, I see the problem, so I'm just going to take care of the problem. Now there are times the problem is bigger than you and you best come to leadership. But there are other times that if we're going to identify the problem, we better be willing to get involved and be intimate with the problem and it become our own, that we are going to solve it ourselves because it's our problem, not just one person's or a few. So guess what happens when we go into the world? What if we had a new rule for our life? You can't identify any problems in your speech that you're not intimately involved in. And guess what? When you're intimately involved in a problem, you don't blurt it out for everybody to know about. Look what Mary didn't do. She didn't go out to everybody around and say, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? We're out of wine. Did you bring anything with you? I know you bring a flask with you. You got anything in there? Hey, guess what? We're out of wine. She didn't tell anybody but the one who could get involved. Now, watch this. She involved Jesus. Again, an intimate scene. See, we don't understand this because we think, first of all, that Mary is making a request to Jesus. This wasn't a request, this was a demand. It wasn't if he was going to do it, it was when. Remember the Old Testament? Honor your father and mother. Mary knew that when she said, Jesus, they have no more wine, he might have said, why are you involving me? His proof was he wasn't ready to reveal who he was to the world, but because Mary got him involved with her problem, she knew he had to answer it. Guess the only other time that Jesus calls his mother woman in the Gospel of John. You have to go to the crucifixion. He's about to die. He turns to John and says, this is your mother. And he says, woman, this is now the one who will care for you. That's an intimate scene on the deathbed. That's an intimate scene in the middle of a problem. Watch this. I'm getting ready to preach. I wasn't going to beat up on you all the time, but I'm getting ready to preach. Mary didn't know the what. She didn't know the how. She didn't know the when. She only knew the who. And she knew that you don't have to know what you need, and you don't have to know, be able to provide what you know you need, and you don't even have to know when it's going to happen. All you have to do is get the who involved. And when you have the who can take care of the what, the when, and the how. Some of you need to know you're in the middle of a problem that is too big for you and you keep looking for the what. You want to know how it's going to be provided for and you don't know. It's okay, you don't have to know the what. You're looking for the when. You're on a time frame, but you don't know when it's going to happen. It's okay, you don't have to know the when. You're looking for the how. You think you know how this thing should go and Jesus does the opposite thing of how you think it should go. That's okay, you don't have to know the how, you just have to know the who. Because when you know the who, He will take care of you. When you know the who, He is able to do immeasurably more than you could dream or imagine. When you know the who and He's involved in your problem, it's not your problem, it's His. He takes it on like it's His own. He is intimately involved in the lives of His people, so will you trust Him with the problem? Whew. Here's the problem. You involve the who in your problem, the who will involve you. So He turns to the servants and says, there's 5 or 6 stone jars, fill them with water. Now understand, there's not an outside hydrant right close. This would have been a lot of time, effort, and resources given to fill these things with water. Now let's be practical. Other people have told me this, of course. And other people tell you this. It's just what we read in science, right? I'm just trying to lighten the mood. Water has the opposite effect of wine. Alcohol dehydrates the body. It's what will eventually cause us to not operate in our right way of thinking. But water rehydrates the body. Now, if I'm the servant, not cursing as in bad language, but cursing as in complaining, this is what I've been doing. What is this guy thinking? We don't need more water. We need wine. We're trying to get the party to continue to have fun. Nobody has fun just drinking water. What is he doing? This is a waste of time. Does he know how heavy these is? Does he know that we'll have to make at least one more additional trip to fill up with the rest of them, that we lost the water on the way? This is a waste of time and effort. This is stupid. I'm not doing that. I think I just would have gone home. This is ridiculous. But he's going to involve us. And here's the problem. He's going to call us to do something that seems insignificant. Something that is counterproductive to what we think ought to be accomplished. And the reason most of us never transform our world is because God never asked us to do the transformation. He asked us to do the insignificant act of obedience that He will transform for the world. Be less pastoral here. There's a sign that my wife shared with me, a little saying going around social media that goes something like this: everyone wants to change the world, but no one wants to change the toilet paper. You've seen this. Everybody that I know of wants to put it in their bathroom. You know why no one wants to change the toilet paper? Because everybody believes it to be insignificant. Now, without going too far and at the risk of losing you for the rest of service, just take 30 seconds and imagine a world without toilet paper. Is changing that roll of toilet paper insignificant? But see, the reason we don't want to do it is because we don't think it's actually going to change the world. Just stop doing it for a while and you'll realize how different the world will change. Most of the things God calls us to when He's calling us to transform the world, it's something that is insignificant. It's going to feel counterintuitive. We're going to say, I see no way how this is going to change the world. But guess what? It is not our job to change the world. It's His. Our job is to be obedient, doing the insignificant thing He has called us to do. And if we're unwilling to do the very thing that is insignificant, we will never be given a stage to do something of significance. I was telling Charles this week, I was talking about Michael Cochran. Some of you know Michael because he led worship here at one time. And Michael is one of the most humble people that I know. And he's also one of the most talented people that I know. I had a friend that I went to school with who is trying to make the same significant stage that Michael's at, you know, get with the big bands. Except I kind of stopped being friends after I realized he was never really my friend. because he only talked to me when he wanted something that would promote his own career. Without sounding judgmental, I can tell you he will never make it to the same stage as Michael Cochran does. You know why? Because he's trying to get there on his own. He's trying to do the significant things to get what he wants. You have to be willing to do the insignificant things and God be responsible for the transformation. So watch this. The servants do what Jesus asked. Now watch. He says, draw some out and take it to the master. When the master tasted the water that had been turned into wine, he didn't know where it came from. So let me ask you this. Where did the transformation happen? Scholarly guess? We don't know. I could probably bring the process down somewhere between them drawing it out and taking it to the master. I don't think he did it as soon as they drew it out. Because if they only drew it out and didn't take to the master never would have tasted it and they never would have completed their act. I think it was while they were on their way. It's like when you look at a map and you're trying to figure out how far away something is, and remember when you were naive and looked at something and think, oh, that's only that far away. That's real close to where I'm at. But you know that when you get in the reality of the distance between the two, it's a whole lot farther than it looks on a map. Can I tell you that looks a whole lot farther? That's a whole lot farther in real life than it is in the text. Between the drawing out and the taking to the master, the act of being obedient, somewhere in the obedience, God transforms it. Here's the point. They were not responsible for the transformation, God was. They were only responsible for doing the insignificant act that they saw no way could change the situation and do it. What I believe God is calling us to as a church is to be a church that transforms our world. And I want to give you some tangible ways to do that. I got to close here quickly. But at the front, and this is how we'll close in just a moment. Will the praise team go ahead and come and prepare to close for us? There's three things. I want you to take this. I'm calling it calling cards because God is calling us into this story. And there's three steps that we need. The first is passion. So instead of us as a church trying to get a whole bunch of people to be passionate about one problem that's in the world, what if we tried less to do that, and what if we just sent each person out into the world to do what they're passionate about? Because if you're not passionate about the thing I'm trying to lead us as a church to do, you're not going to be involved in it. And that's okay. You know why? Because you're not concerned about the thing that concerns me. So start with this. Start by being intimate with the problems that are in your world. Just start observing this week, listening to your coworkers, listening to your family. Some of you are like, I already know the problems. Well, give God time to speak about the problems, will you? And just write them all down. And then come to the one. Come to the one problem that keeps you awake at night. Because if all the problems of the world kept us awake, we'd never sleep because there's too many. And what happens is when we look at all the problems, we think that's so big and our little part is so insignificant. Okay, then just start with the one that you're passionate about. So, I think we know you're passionate about foster care, or you wouldn't have done what you've done. But not everybody in this room, that may not be your passion that keeps you awake at night. So what is your passion? And then what... let me go to the next one. After you've identified your passion, identify one action that God is calling you to take. And remember, it's going to seem so small that it won't make a difference. It's going to seem counterintuitive to what you think you need to be doing. But what is He calling you to do? And write down the one action. One problem, one action. And then, guess what we want to do as a church? So I've decided, at least what God is teaching me, instead of me trying to lead a whole bunch of people to do what I think God is telling me, why don't we just become a church that allows God to speak to each individual, and whatever He's speaking to you, we will find ways to help. So instead of us solving one problem in the world, what if we solved 70 problems in the world because each one of us had a different thing we're doing. When you come to church, guess what? You get filled up with what you need as resources. And by the way, what you need, because remember what I said? It's not about the when or the how or the what. So you don't need money. You probably don't need all that much training as what you think you need, because if you have the who, which is what church provides, you have everything you need. We will help where we can. So write down one problem, one action, and then what is one thing that you need God to do to make transformation possible. Some of you are trying to transform your families. You can't do it. Can I say it this way? So stop trying to be the transformer, because you're not it. Be the person God has called you to be. Do the things He's calling you to do. And at the end of the day, pray to God, God, I've done all that I can, but I am in desperate need of You to do with it and multiply it and use it way beyond myself. And guess what? He will. All right. Now I got to close. This was the first sign of which He would reveal His glory. Why was this the first miracle Jesus performed? It didn't change a person's life. There were no lepers, there were no blind people, no paralyzed men. There was no resurrection from the dead. Why this one? You know why? Because there was a problem that God used people to solve. And I think the whole mission and kingdom of God is about this: using inadequate, empty-handed people like servants to help solve the problems of His world through His glory. And guess what? This is the first of many signs. There's coming a day where we will sit at the feast of our Lord, of the many signs, that we will be seated in heaven with Him and all of His glory, because we will know that He and He alone is the one that transforms. And so every step of the way, this is pointing us to the day when He will come in all of His glory, transforming us and the world. And we get to be part of it today. So here's how I want you to come. You know what? If you're not interested in doing this, you don't have to come. I'm not going to look up. But if you're interested in it, would you come and grab a piece of paper, take it with you this week, pray over these things for 7 days, and bring it back with you next week? Will you do that? All right, let's stand together and close with this song.